Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Katrina Wolford of the Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum will tell us about their annual meeting, and we'll meet their guest speaker, UAF History Professor Terrence Cole. Bill Merck will preview Woosh K's first open mic of the seventh season. Theater at Latitude 58 will highlight their production of White Christmas, and we'll get an update from Eagle Crest. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon, currently 38 degrees at the Juno Airport.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. From New York to Los Angeles to Chicago to Mandan, North Dakota, thousands of people took to the streets Tuesday in what organizers call a National Day of Action against the Dakota Access Pipeline Project. Police arrested dozens of protesters in several cities. One of the gatherings occurred in Eugene, Oregon. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Water is life. Water is life.
Despite the heavy rains, crowds of people clustered under umbrellas and tents to voice their concerns over the Dakota Access Pipeline and its path through part of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The rally took place outside the Army Corps of Engineers office and was peaceful. Among the speakers was Sarah Bilt, a Eugene resident of Apache Yaqui heritage. She's pleased that President Obama has helped halt development of the pipeline until the Corps has reviewed its options.
Rerouting the pipeline isn't going to change anything. It's just going to be affecting a different group of people. We believe that the only way to protect the water is to stop all pipelines from being constructed and used in the country.
Bilt says once Donald Trump becomes president, it's uncertain how he'll act given his business-friendly background. In the meantime, she says she'll help route supplies to the protest site so Native demonstrators stay warm and fed through the harsh winter. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Morton County Sheriff's Office reports they arrested more than two dozen people in Cannonball, North Dakota. They claim protesters tried to block a railroad track with a pickup and attempted to set the vehicle on fire. Meanwhile, the backers of the pipeline are going to federal court to try and clear the way for the project. Energy Transfer Partners and Sunoco Logistics Partners filed a claim in district court in Washington, D.C., seeking a judgment that they have the legal right to continue pipeline construction. They say they do not need any further approval from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to install the pipeline under the Missouri River in North Dakota. They say the project has been granted every permit, approval, certificate, and right-of-way needed. The Corps announced Monday it needed further analysis before allowing the pipeline to go forward. The pipeline companies say the project is about three-quarters of the way completed. The Department of Interior is canceling 15 oil and gas leases at the Badger II Medicine area in Montana. The 130,000-acre area is considered sacred by the Blackfeet Nation of Montana and Blackfeet Tribes of Canada. At a press conference, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said the leases should never have been issued in the first place. She said this newest action recognizes a new tone for how business should be done in the future.
They're painful lessons from the past, certainly painful lessons that the Blackfeet Nation has had to fight. Painful lessons that their partners in the region and in the environmental community have been helpful in doing. Painful lessons that land managers, the Forest Service, and the BLM have learned from that have really changed the nature of the way we lease for oil and gas, the way we understand our landscapes in a more holistic fashion.
The leases were originally issued more than 30 years ago in National Forest Service land outside of Glacier National Park and the Blackfeet Reservation. Devon Energy voluntarily relinquished the leases. Two leases are still left, but officials say it's unclear who holds those. Blackfeet Chairman Harry Barnes praised the agreement that he says is born from relationships.
We have developed some fantastic relationships that share a common core belief in that some things are sacred, special, and not to be disturbed.
Barnes speculates that the agreement came because of the organized opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline, although Jewell did not confirm that. Dave Hager, president of Devon Energy, said the company appreciates how important the land is to the Blackfeet people, and the agreement is in keeping with the company's core value of being a good neighbor. For National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian Country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes past the top of the hour. And joining me now in the studio is Katrina Wolford of the Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum. Welcome to the show, Katrina.
Thanks, Scott.
And also UAF History Professor Terrence Cole. Welcome down to Juno, Terrence.
Thanks, Scott.
Nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
Let's start with you, Katrina. What is the Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum?
We are sort of a support group for the museum. We're in charge of fundraising and membership, and then we support the museum by buying new equipment and chairs and things like that. And part of our annual agenda is to host a speaker with our public annual meeting. And this year, our speaker is Terrence Cole. And our meeting will be tonight at Rockwell. We do a short business meeting at 6:30. And then Terrence's presentation will begin at 7 o'clock.
Cool. How did you find Terrence?
Oh, that's an
interesting
question.
Well, I think, I can answer this, Scott. They tried to get Bob Dylan. And, he's... He went into hiding because of the Nobel.
After the Nobel,
so I think that's why, really. Yeah. I think, and then they went through everyone else in the known universe.
And then Terrence
and then
was just the logical choice.
Yeah, exactly.
After Bob Dylan, absolutely.
Yeah. So they only had 6 billion other options, Scott. So really, I feel pretty lucky to be here. So.
Well, it's great to have you. What are you going to talk about tonight?
Well, it's the Friends of the... What's the acronym for that, by the way?
It's we don't use the acronym, but we say the whole phrase.
All right. Well, anyway, the Friends of Museum, I'm really delighted. I'm going to talk about actually a really great old-time friend of Juno, James Wickersham, the former delegate, district court judge. And I always think to myself as a, teacher and writer, why should I care? And I always tell my students when they start giving a talk, I always say, wait, why should I care? Because, of course, most people don't care. But the answer with James Wickersham is people really should care because so much of modern Alaska, in fact, the roots were laid by him in some ways. And also, one reason why people, I think, should care is that Wickersham is a good antidote to modern politics. You may not know this, Scott, but the election just happened in America. It wasn't publicized very well. but it's just good to remember that political campaigns have always been bitterly divisive, actually. Not saying that this one didn't set a record of some type, but it's looking back at Wickersham's political career, you also see how tough things have always been in the political arena. Democracy, even in Alaska, has never been clean. But I'm going to talk about Wickersham's life in Juno, his literary accomplishments. The main thing, I think... Katrina is a book publisher, and we got interested in James Wickersham's, really his memoir, Old Yukon, which he wrote in the 1930s. And it's been in print ever since he first wrote it. But all truth, the original was a terrible book. I mean, he was a terrible writer. And I told the joke this morning, and I think I'll tell it again because Katrina liked it so much. But my friend Michael Carey used to say, if John C. Calhoun wrote poetry, it would begin... Well, Katrina, what would be the first word? You don't remember?
I remember.
Well, what was it?
Whereas,
yeah. or a typical, like we're in the legislature in session, there's probably at least 60 people here who might start a poem with the word whereas. But that's kind of how Wickersham wrote. And his original memoir wasn't even edited. And he tried year after year to publish the darn thing. Finally, his law publisher published it in the 1930s, and really with what we decided to do, what I decided to do, is to take it and fix it. And so I edited it, I took a bunch of stuff out, but I amplified it with his diary, because one of the great actually Wickersham's probably greatest literary treasure is his diary, which he kept from January 1st, 1900, to the date of his death in October 1939. Now, Scott, you may be wondering, how many days is that? Are you curious? How many days would you guess is between January 1st, 1900 and 1939? What would you say?
A bunch.
Yeah, a bunch is a very good answer. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's 14,540 days. And I even included leap years. I counted an extra day for each leap year. But in his diary, he often wrote a vastly different account of what happened than in his memoir. So I amplified the memoir with his diary entries. And we're just so lucky because the Alaska State Library here, the great people at the State Library, the Historical Library, transcribed this almost, 40 years of diaries. And so it's all available on the web. But putting that together with his memoir gives a great picture of a really terrifically fascinating guy.
It, in a sense, then, it's sort of half memoir, half biography, little autobiographical mix in there with your touch.
Yeah, it's mostly his autobiographical mix. I mean, like things, because he was a politician, his published work was written for public consumption. The diary necessarily wasn't. So he has a couple of really great, indiscretions that he commits in the diary about saying about people, including on his trip to Mount McKinley in 1903. I might mention something about tonight. He was coming back from the trip, and he makes it sound like they were all jolly fellows getting along. But in the diary, he thought they were going to kill him and that they were going to abandon him, leave him out there because they just weren't getting along all well. But anyway, Wickersham was responsible for the Alaska Railroad, the University of Alaska, Denali National Park, the Alaska school system, really, and in a way, Alaska self-representation. He was a big early proponent of it. And there's, of course, the Juneau House here in Juneau, but there's also one in Eagle and in Fairbanks. Mm. So those are really the three cities in Alaska that he called home, but for the longest amount of time, it was here in Juneau.
What kind of person was he when he wasn't working? On his free time, what would he do?
He was a cranky, old... Even when he was young, he was old. He was always cranky. He was an industrious, amazing guy. You cannot imagine a modern politician do what he did in terms of his literary output alone. He compiled the Alaska reports. And they were sometimes called the Wickersham reports. He compiled all the law cases pertaining to Alaska up to the 1930s. He helped write the first comprehensive bibliography of Alaska, which was actually the first publication of the University of Alaska. For a long time, I thought this bibliography was a fake. I thought he just hired somebody to do it. But it's absolutely clear when you look at it, right? He did the work, and he worked on it for some 20 years while he was a full-time politician. He amassed really what's the greatest, second greatest, probably Alaskana Library, which is the Alaska Historical Library, still forms the nucleus of their collection. So as a book collector, a scholar, and political roughhouser, I always think you can think of James Wickersham as Alaska's first angry man in Congress. Now, over the years, we've had several angry men in Congress. I don't know if we have an angry woman in Congress, but I'm not sure. Lisa doesn't seem angry. Does she to you, Katrina? Katrina doesn't want to answer that question. But anyway, we certainly have had our share of angry men, like Ted and Don Young, of course. But really, they didn't hold any... comparison to Wickersham. Wickersham famously in 1911 got into a fist fight because he heard this guy mutter under his breath that he was a liar, and he jumped up and he grabbed the guy. And one account says he took a chair and tried to hit the guy with the chair, but I don't think it was really a chair. It maybe was a folding chair, it wasn't a real chair. So we're going to talk about Wickersham's life and any questions that people have. He's just a great, he's a person worth remembering, I think, especially in this, like I say, this political time, thinking how politics has always been a rough game.
Okay. So that's tonight, Katrina, correct?
Yes. The doors open at 6. There will be a Friends of the City Museum business meeting from 6:30 to 7, and then Terrence will speak at 7.
Okay. What else is on the radar of the FOJDCM, Friends of the Juneau Douglas City Museum.
Wait, can you say that again, Scott?
Well, that's
I love acronyms.
That's it for right now. So this is our big annual event and our membership drive. So if you're a member, you can get in for free. And if you are not yet a member, we ask that you make a $5 donation at the door.
How much does it cost to be a member?
There are different levels.
Oh, different levels.
We're going to tell you all about it when you show up.
And Terrence, your presentation, how long do you think it will last?
Well, a few hours, yeah, basically, right? Is that what you said? No, I think a half an hour, right? An hour? I can talk for as long or short as is needed.
I'm going to interrupt, an hour, hour and a half, something okay. like that.
It won't be too, Scott, are you worried it's going to be too long? Is that what you're
No. But sort of closing thoughts, Terrence, what sort of impressed you most about him? You've answered it to some extent so far, but, you know, what was it about him? You spent probably a lot of time in his diary.
Yeah, I did. I read all the 40 years of the diary. And I think, just the energy, in fact, that it took. This was his, he found meaning in life through this political work. And in some ways, you know, it's such a unrewarding job, politics, because there's always almost at least half the people who hate you for one reason or another. But to be able to persevere and keep on, I think that's kind of an admirable thing. And also to keep this, just the simple act of keeping a diary for those many years, it is just talk about the guy's endurance. You know, it's amazing, really. So I think Alaska is lucky that they had this figure, because really, before the Second World War, he's the most important political figure in Alaska. He dominated the first half of the 20th century the way Ted Stevens did the second. And that's worth, I think, remembering. So.
All right. You've been listening to UAF history professor Terrence Cole. He'll be speaking tonight at the Rockwell Ballroom, upstairs or downstairs,
upstairs.
Katrina? Upstairs in the ballroom, starting at 7. But before that, you can come for the business meeting at 6:30 for the Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum. Thank you both for coming in to the show today. Anything else you'd like to add?
Terrence?
Oh, I could add a lot, but no, I just hope everybody comes out. And thanks very much for having us, Scott.
Anytime. Thank you.
Scott.
Go catch the river, it's running. Out to sea on sands. Well, I've netted a mighty lot savings. Babe, I've got a plan. You and me, it's the story of the chrome heart. It's dreams and illusions, hard to tell apart. All coffee and gasoline, all the miles in between, sunrise and sunset, and all the small towns we ain't seen yet. Where the people seem to be getting by in spite of the rent. A little piece of history in the making, confusing what we were given and what we were taking. Turn it all upside down. We see the stars when we're looking at the ground, shining all around. I hold on to my hand. Sing me a love song. Oh. We'll be right back. So many things we thought we couldn't live without, we just gave them away. You and me, it's the story of the chrome heart. Never said I knew, never said I had a clue. All you turns and I bars, bitter ends and broken hearts. All this and nothing else, someday we'll make story to tell. And if no one else will listen, baby, you know I always will. A little piece of history in the making, confusing the way we're living, what we were taking. Turn it all upside down. See the stars when we're looking at the ground. Shining.
Did you know that one out of three Americans has prediabetes and doesn't know it? Prediabetes puts you at risk for developing type 2 diabetes, which can lead to complications like glaucoma and kidney disease. The good news is you can prevent diabetes by acting early. Learn your risk for prediabetes by taking a short quiz at diabetes.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services and the American Diabetes Association. Aired by the Alaska Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, November 16th. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 22 minutes after the hour. Joining me now in the studio is Austin Tagaban, and he's here to tell us about WooshKay's first open mic of the season. Welcome to the show, Austin.
Hi, Scott. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. I am well on this beautiful afternoon here in Juno. So you wear a couple hats. You're a student at UAS. Mm-hmm. And you're part of Woocheen. Tell us what Woocheen is.
Yeah, so Woocheen is a student leadership group out on campus, and it's housed in the NRSC, which is the Native and Rural Student Center, and that's sort of a center on campus for rural students and Alaska Native students to come together and have a space that feels a little more homey than spaces on campus can be sometimes.
Okay, and so as Woocheen, you're partnering with WooshKay. Mm-hmm. Tell us about WooshKay in case people don't know what that is.
Yeah, so WooshKinadei is a local organization, a local community organization, and they put on poetry slams and open mics for the community. One every month, and so it alternates every month. One is so this month we have there'll be a open mic, and next month will be a poetry slam, and so on and so forth.
And it all leads up to the grand slam at the end of the season, right?
Yeah. So eventually there's a grand slam, which takes the winners of the season's poetry slams, and those winners all compete to be the grand slam winner. And the grand slam just happened in October, and the winner this year was Nathan Block.
All right.
A UAS student. He might graduate this year too. So.
Oh, that's great. Let's see. So the first open mic is this Friday at 7 p.m. in the Klan House, right?
Yeah, in the Klan House at the Soboloff Building downtown. I don't know the address, but it's right by Sea Alaska. And the
beautiful Cedar Building downtown.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So this is the second time that Woocheen has hosted an event with WooshKinadei. And last year we hosted an open mic in the Klan House as well. So Hopefully it'll be a tradition. And also Woocheen is going to host an event again with WooshKinadei, I think a slam, in February. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's February.
Okay. So again, signups are, people should get there at about 6:30.
Yeah.
Right? And then the event starts at 7.
Yeah.
Describe for our listeners who haven't been to an open mic, what's it look like? How many people compete? What's the atmosphere like?
Yeah, so it depends really on how many people show up and want to perform. So this is a non-competitive event, and you can show up and do anything you want. You can read poetry. It doesn't even have to be your own poetry. You can read poetry from a book, or you can sing a song, or, you know, maybe even, like, if you wanted to perform a short skit with someone, I don't know, that'd be pretty cool too. So it's pretty free form, and it depends on how many people sign up, but in the past, there I've seen, you know, probably 11 or 12 people. So there's and there's always room for more performers if we make time. It's not bad to have too many people show up. So,
and about how long do these open mics or poetry slams go?
I think it'll be about an hour and a half. So, yeah.
You know, the events that I've been to, it seems like the audience is incredibly supportive. Would you agree?
Yeah, yeah. It's really, it's a great environment. So if you've never performed before, we would really love to see you there. And it would be great to welcome you onto the stage for your first performance, because I know it's scary, but...
And you've performed yourself, right?
Yeah, I have. I really enjoy performing. I actually got to perform at the Grand Slam. I wasn't competing, but I got asked to perform, and it was really, it's an enjoyable experience.
What would be your advice to a newcomer who's thinking about coming this Friday and they might want to perform? What would you say to them?
I would say try it. So don't be shy. The audience will be very supportive. It's one of, one of the co-founders, Christine Ami Erickson, she always tells me that one of her favorite things is when you see someone who is someone who you don't expect to perform. You know, it's like this guy who looks like a lumberjack, and he walks up and he's like, "I'm going to read a poem," and he just blows your mind. And she also says that it's one of her favorite things too. She says this when the person finishes reading and they look up and they're so surprised because everyone's clapping for them and they're really happy. And there are a lot of great moments to see on stage. So.
And remind us again sort of the forms that people can perform in.
Yeah, so you can read a poem, one of your own poems or another person's poem. Just make sure you attribute that poem to whoever wrote it. And you can also, you could sing a song, or you can maybe perform a skit. I don't know. Be creative about it.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I bet you have a Facebook event.
Yes, there's going. A Facebook event. Which I've been sharing, and I know Christy has been sharing, and other people have been sharing. So if you look it up on Facebook, it's Woosh Kinadeyi. I'll try and spell it. WooshKinadeyi.
Okay, that's this Friday. It sounds like a lot of fun, Austin. Thank you for coming on the show today. Are we missing anything? Anything you want to add?
That's all. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 16th of November, 2016. It's the birthday of Mary Margaret McBride, born in Paris, Missouri, 1899, one of the first radio talk show hosts who... in 20 years, interviewed more than 30,000 guests, politicians, writers, artists, entertainers. In the late 1940s, she had 6 million daily listeners. She talked with a Missouri twang, though she spent most of her life in New York City, and she never announced in advance the names of the guests who would appear on her show. It was Mary Margaret McBride who made daytime radio profitable. It's the birthday of W.C. Handy, born Florence, Alabama, 1873, the son and grandson of Methodist ministers who did not approve of his going into the music business. They expected him to become a minister. He became a piano player, went on the road with bands, wound up in Memphis, and he became the first person to write down the music that would become known as the blues. His first song, Memphis Blues, later his most famous song, St. Louis Blues. He was the first person to write sheet music for it and to make it accessible for mass consumption. It's the birthday of the novelist Andrea Barrett, born Boston 1954, author of fiction about botanists, oceanographers, geologists. Her novel, The Voyage of the Narwhal, came out in 1998. It's the birthday of the novelist Chinua Achebe, born in Ogidi, Nigeria in 1930. His great-uncle was the man who first received European missionaries into his village. His father was an early convert to Christianity. Achebe, the boy, was baptized as a Christian, spent his childhood reading the Bible every day. Went to a school run by Europeans, read Charles Dickens and Jonathan Swift and Joseph Conrad. His novel, Things Fall Apart, came out in 1958, one of the first novels ever written about European colonization from the point of view of the colonized. And it's the birthday of the novelist José Saramago, born in a little village northeast of Lisbon in 1922. Parents couldn't afford an academic school, so he went to a technical school, became an auto mechanic. His first novel, Land of Sin, came out when he was 24 years old. Then he stopped writing fiction for the next 30 years. Until, in his mid-50s, unemployed, blacklisted by the government for his political activities, he went back to writing fiction. His novel, Raised from the Ground, about three generations of a peasant family, and his novel, Blindness, in 1997. A year later, 1998, José Saramago won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Here's a poem for today by Stephen Dobbins, Recognitions. The awful imbalance that occurs with age when you suddenly see that more friends have died than remain alive, and at times their memory seems so real that the latest realization of a death can become a second, smaller death. All those talks cut off in mid-sentence, all those plans tossed in the trash, what can you do but sit out on the porch when evening comes, the day's last light reddens the leaves of the copper beech. Recognitions, a poem by Stephen Dobbins from his collection The Day's Last Light Reddens the Leaves of the Copper Beech, published by Boa Editions Limited and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 27 minutes until the top of the hour, and I've been joined in the studio now by the crew of White Christmas, Karen Allen. She's the director of White Christmas. Thanks for coming on the show, Karen.
Thank you for having us.
And Claire, thank you for being here. Katie and Kai, thank you all for being on the show today. All right, so White Christmas opens this Friday. Is that right?
Yes, 7 o'clock, Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium.
Okay, and runs through the weekend. You have shows on Saturday and Sunday.
We do. We have two on Saturday, a 2 p.m. matinee and a 7 p.m. evening show, and then we have a Sunday matinee at 2.
All right, Karen, will you tell us a little bit about Theater at Latitude 58?
Theater at Latitude 58, the artistic director, Cinnamon Simpson, and I were just talking a few nights ago, and we realized this is our 20th play in 4 years. We've been busy. We're a family theater company. We do theater education pretty much from cradle to grave. Our youngest performer in this play is 8, and the oldest is somewhere north of 50. If they're older than me, I don't make them disclose, and I'm 42, so there you have it.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about this production of White Christmas. Where was it inspired?
Well, we were looking for a good fall musical, and literally everybody watches this movie every year. It's based on the 1954 movie that starred Bing Crosby and Rosemary Clooney and Danny Kaye, and it's a classic, and it was adapted for the stage in 2009, and it fit our demographics so well. It had roles for characters of all ages, has a gigantic ensemble, and 21 Irving Berlin songs. What could be bad?
Let's start over here. Kai, tell us about your character in this musical.
My character is Rhonda Bobsey. She is a more flirtatious chorus girl, and I'll just leave it at that.
And I understand you come in some kind of detergent box.
Our first scene as the Roto-Rooter, as it's called, we're in Oxydol detergent boxes, where our main line is, for purity.
Right. They're part of a commercial on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they do dance on wearing giant detergent boxes, although Kai says travel size on it, because she's the smallest.
Okay. Katie, tell us about your character.
I play the seamstress and also part of the ensemble. The seamstress is, like, part of the grunts of the, like, Bob Wallace company.
She spends a lot of time chasing costumes and throws a gown across the stage at one point.
All right. And Claire, tell us about your role.
I'm a train passenger, and I'm also part of the ensemble.
Okay. Going back to Kai, what's been the most, enjoyable part about getting ready for this show for you?
I think it's just getting to know the cast members, because you have so many people that you wouldn't have met anywhere else other than here, and you get to learn their stories and get to know them as people. And it's just really great. We're
How
a giant
many
family.
Of you are there, would you say?
The cast has 41 performers, plus we have an orchestra. We have more than 100 costumes.
Wow, this is big.
We're our own circus.
Katie, how about you? What's been your favorite part of this production so far?
Learning about tap dancing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is this your first time for this production?
Yeah.
Fun? Challenging? Mm-hmm.
Both.
Okay. All right. Claire, how about you? What's been the best part?
I like all the singing that we get to learn.
Okay. All right. Karen, what as you've seen, you said 41 people?
41.
When did you start rehearsing?
We started rehearsing at the end of August.
Okay, so it's been a while. You've been working hard.
We've been working very hard. We had exactly 3 people in the cast who had ever touched a pair of tap shoes before.
What's been most fulfilling for you watching this develop?
Oh, as Kai said, we're a family. And if this show has a theme at all, it's that I have the most amazing friends in this world. I am a terrible dancer. I have 3 left feet. So I call my friends Bridget Lujan and Heather Mitchell and say, guys, I need choreography. Come help. And they do. And they look amazing. My friend Emily Ferguson here makes me the most amazing, beautiful costumes. Sharon Comstock is sitting here waiting, and she made Oxydol detergent boxes that my people could dance in. Amy Bibb, when I said, hey, do you want to conduct a musical? She said, okay, and she came up with an orchestra. I mean, really, this is my friend George Watt says, okay, we need to redesign the set because we thought we were going to have 25 and we have 41. Let's just redesign the set and make everybody fit on the stage.
Okay. So again, this is this Friday.
It
opens, right? 7 p.m. at mm-hmm. Thunder Mountain. Okay. And then there's a show on Saturday at 2 and 7?
Correct.
Okay. And Sunday at 2. As we get ready to close the interview here, is there anything else that any of you would like to share about your roles? Any lines that you may have memorized? Go ahead, Katie.
I have this one line that's really fun where I'm pushing the assistant seamstress across the stage, and the line is, hurry, hurry, hurry. And we're always, like, trying not to run over people in the wings because I run really fast.
They come through like a train wreck. It's amazing.
That sounds like definitely some physical comedy involved as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for coming on the show. Is there anything else anyone wants to add?
Tickets are available on Vendini, at Hearthside Books, at the Jack, and at the Door. And they are $15 for adults and $10 for students and seniors.
If somebody wanted to find you online, where can they do that?
You can find us on Facebook, Theater at Latitude 58, and we have a website, theateratlatitude58.com.
All right. Again, thank you all for coming on the show. Karen, Claire, Katie, and Kai, have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There has never been such a day in Beverly Hills, LA. But it's December the 24th, and I'm longing to be up north. Oh, they'd be merry and bright. Oh,
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 15 minutes to the top of the hour. And I'm joined in the studio by Matt Lillard. He is the general manager up at Eagle Crest. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thank you for having us.
And also Jeffra Clow. She's the director of sales and marketing and also the Snow School. Jeffra, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us in the studio this afternoon, Scott.
It's cold outside, you too.
It is. We're so excited.
All right. As part of this excitement, the Warren Miller movies are coming up, what, tomorrow and Friday?
Yep, tomorrow and Friday. So the annual Warren Miller movie this year is titled Here, There, and Everywhere, which I think is just perfect. And it's going to show at 6:30 tomorrow night or 7 o'clock on Friday night at the Rockwell Ballroom. So this is going to be a great way to get excited about the season, watch a great, good ski film, ski and snowboard film. Warren Miller is always very family-friendly, and they do some great scenes. They've got some footage from Alaska, from the Cordova and Valdez area, and just, I think, a lot of things to get everybody really excited. And this year, Warren Miller, who actually started the Warren Miller movies years and years ago, is actually going to be on there as well. So it's pretty exciting. Tickets are $16 at the door, and you can find all the information at skijuno.com.
And there are door prizes as well, right?
There is. We've partnered with many of our local businesses in town, Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, Borderline, Alaska Powder Descents, just to name a few, and they have sponsored door prizes. So we'll have some door prizes to give away, and then Warren Miller every year has a big grand door prize that you can get entered to win. But I think the most important thing is to get out there, get psyched about the season, and watch some really good skiing and riding on the big screen.
Okay. And Matt, you were telling me that all proceeds go to the Eagle Crest Foundation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Tell our listeners about what the Eagle Crest Foundation is.
Yeah, so the foundation is an organization that its mission is to support the goals at Eagle Crest and things we're trying to do up there. So in years past, they were a huge part of raising money for the Black Bear Chairlift and the Porcupine Chairlift. And they also fund our Books to Boards program and or help us fund it. And that's a great program.
Remind us what that is, too.
Yeah. Jeffrey can actually pick up on that.
Yep. So we work with the middle schools. And this year, we're actually adding high school component into that to identify youth in the community that could benefit by skiing or snowboarding up at Eagle Crest. If they have good grades and good behavior, then they can be part of the program. And for that, they get the benefit of free lift tickets, free transportation, free rentals, equipment rentals. They can take advantage of some lessons. And they have a ride club and get out there on the mountain and ride together every weekend as well. So,
how do those students get identified?
We work with the schools, and the schools identify the students, ones that are need and could benefit by skiing or snowboarding up at Eagle Crest. Because people laugh at me, but we teach more than just skiing or snowboarding up at Eagle Crest. So the Books to Boards program works on that, teaches the kids the students' life skills, self-confidence, teamwork, and it's a great program, and it's now in its sixth or seventh year, and so we're excited to add a high school component on that, too, so we're feeling our way down that road.
Great, and I know that we get to see you here as we lead into the ski season, I think on a monthly basis, if not more than that.
A weekly basis,
yes. And so let us know more about that. It's really interesting. Sorry, Matt, I sort of cut you off. You were on Books to Boards and talking about the Eagle Crest Foundation.
Certainly, so the Eagle Crest Foundation helps fund the Books to Boards program. And then they help us with our other goals. So, you know, one of the big things that came out of our master plan a couple of years ago is the community wanted more hiking trails. And more options for summertime use up there. So the foundation is, you know, helping to raise money for that and helping us put in trails. And really, you know, it's in a relatively quiet phase at the moment, the foundation. But, you know, at our next chance to if we need to raise some money and get something accomplished, it's a great avenue for us to do so.
And tell us about the trails. I understand there's some mountain bike development going up there in the summer.
Yeah, so there's really two components right now. This summer we worked on the Ridge Trail, which is a hiking multi-use trail at the very top. So there's been a trail that was put in the 70s, early 80s, but the boardwalk had been, the mountain had reclaimed it. So we went and tore that out and hardened it. It's a fantastic trail, and people that got up there this fall really loved it and looking forward to next summer. And then lower down on the mountain, we're working on a mountain bike trail with the Juneau Mountain Bike Alliance and the foundation, and that's going down on the Sourdough Trail. And next summer we should be able to complete it, which will be from the top of Hooter down to the bottom. It'll be the first dedicated downhill mountain bike trail in Juneau.
If somebody's never been hiking up at Eagle Crest, sort of describe that. I know that's sort of summertime stuff, but I know there are some great opportunities up there. I mean, you can hike from the parking lot in several directions, right?
Certainly, yeah. So you go in the parking lot, and we've got some great trail maps in the summer for hiking trails, too. And you check those out. You can go downhill, and you can hit the Treadwell Trail and take it all the way down to Treadwell and Douglas, if you're so inclined. Or if you want to head uphill, you basically start following the road. The mountain road, and that'll take you up to the top. And once there's the Ridge Trail that goes out to the backside and look down on Stevens Passage. Next summer, we also hope to complete a trail out to Dix Lake. And then eventually here, get a trail out to Cropley Lake as well.
And all these trails are free,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, no, they're built for the community to use, and they're definitely free.
Okay.
But and just one more on that, Scott. We do have information on those trails on our website. It's on the homepage of the website during the off-season. It's now moved into it, but you can still find information on all the summer trails on the hiking trails on our website at skijuneau.com.
And that's all for next June, because it's going to start dumping snow.
It is.
Any day now. And snowmaking?
Yeah. So obviously it's cold out there today, and it's really working out well. We sat there on Monday and said, well, hopefully it's going to get nice and cold. The ground's going to freeze Tuesday, Wednesday. Tomorrow morning, we'll be starting firing up the snow guns on nice frozen muskeg, which is an ideal scenario for us. And we're going to start over in the Porcupine area, get all four guns running. We're thinking about, anywhere between 4 and 5 days over in Porcupine, and we should have enough snow to open over there. And then we'll move up over towards the bottom of Sourdough and the bottom of Ptarmigan. It's looking like some natural snow might start coming in on Monday. So, just a week ago, it was abnormally warm. And I think actually in the newspaper I saw it was one record-breaking early November. But I think it's going to flip to cold. The forecast looks really good. The team up at the mountain is getting ready and, making sure that everybody's not thinking it's going to keep being warm here. But we're going to be open on December 3rd, I'm thinking.
Oh, wow. December 3rd.
That's right.
That's it.
Very exciting. Okay. Well, thank you both for coming on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just a reminder that Warren Miller is going to be at the Rockwell tomorrow at 6:30. And Friday, starting at 7 o'clock, tickets are $16 at the door. And you can find everything Eagle Crest at skijuneau.com.
All right. We'll see you at the Rockwell, and then we'll see you on December 3rd. Right?
Thank you, Scott.
Thank
yep.
you. Listening to a Juneau afternoon.
This is Bird Note. More than a few birds take their names from the distinctive calls they make.
And maybe the most vivid example is the call of the bobwhite. It's the only quail native to eastern North America. Officially known as the northern bobwhite, this chunky quail lives in brushy open country, grasslands, farmlands, and the edges of woods. Bobwhites are smartly feathered in rust and brown with bold face markings. Except during breeding season, bobwhites form coveys of up to 20 birds. They're one of the most economically important game birds in the U.S. But bobwhites are in trouble in most of their native range. Breaking habitat into smaller, separate pieces poses a major problem for the quail, as does the extensive use in farming of herbicides to control weeds. In addition, the birds are not adapted to the high density and close spacing of pine plantations. As a result, bobwhite numbers have plummeted. Like a number of other species of grasslands and open country, bobwhites will require more focused management of their habitat to meet the stiff conservation challenges they now face. Is there a bird or topic you would like to hear about on Bird Note? Give us a whistle. Or better yet, contact us at info@birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow I'll be your host again, and Ernestine Hayes, author of The Tao of Raven, or The Tao of Raven, will present her Friday night evening at Egan presentation. She'll preview that. We'll hear about the November 19th Con Brio concert series at Northern Light United Church. We'll learn about the National Guard toy drive. And Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up, as she is every Thursday. Let's take a look at the weather here. The forecast for tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a low around 24 and a northeast wind around 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Thursday, calls for mostly sunny skies with a high near 35, north winds around 20 miles per hour. And going into Friday, the forecast calls for mostly sunny skies with a high near 33. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Thank you.